This is the Law and the Future of War podcast, brought to you from the University of Queensland Law School. Through conversation with experts in technology, law and military affairs, this series explores how international law regulates new military technologies.
In this interview, we're speaking with Dr. Charles Adiogun Phillips about the history of guilty pleas in international criminal law. As an author of a chapter on the same topic, as part of the edited works, Contemporary International Criminal Law Issues, Contributions in Pursuit of Accountability for Africa and the World. The challenges associated with running international criminal trials are extensive, and establishing a process for plea bargaining to satisfactorily address some of the legal challenges with atrocity crimes is an even more delicate one. Today, we're talking with Dr. Adiogun Phillips about how this process has evolved over the course of the ad hoc tribunals and what plea bargaining means in terms of accountability for international criminal offences. Charles A. Adiogun Phillips is an accomplished international lawyer and former lead international prosecutor. He founded the cross-border law firm of Charles Anthony LLP following a distinguished legal career at the UN, where he successfully led teams of international prosecutors in 12 precedent-setting genocide trials before the United Nations ICTR. Arguably making him one of the most experienced and successful genocide prosecutors in history. In 2021, he was called to the Bar of England and Wales as a transferring solicitor by the Honourable Society of Lincoln's Inn and practices as a barrister from the prestigious Guernica 37 International Justice Chambers in London and The Hague. In 2022, he was awarded the degree of the Doctor of Laws honoris causa by his alma mater, Warwick University, in recognition of his outstanding contribution to the development of international criminal law. He's also variously written on international criminal investigations, law and practice, and is the focal point for Nigeria at the ICC Bar Association.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. We're really excited to talk to you about your chapter about guilty pleas and talk to you about guilty pleas in international criminal law more generally. So thank you for making the time to speak to us.
You're most welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Finally, once we worked out time zones. So what prompted you to really focus in on this issue of guilty pleas in international criminal law?
I think because guilty pleas in international criminal law are quite unique in terms of their occurrence, their subject matter, and of course, the great complexities that are involved in negotiating them. In leading the pioneering prosecution of 12 genocide cases before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which was one of the two ad hoc international criminal tribunals established since the end of the Second World War. I was therefore not only privy to many of the challenges encountered therein, but I also was fortunate enough to tackle several novel issues never addressed before in international law. Mm-hmm. One of such challenges was that of procuring guilty pleas in the context of large-scale international crimes. In this regard, it must be noted, of course, that there was a complete absence of guilty pleas in the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg, or in fact, at the International Military Tribunal for the Far East. So, with little or no precedent guiding us, my colleagues and I were involved in very pioneering work in negotiating guilty pleas at the ICTY and at the ICTR between 1996 and maybe 2010 when I left. And it was with that backdrop that the evolution of the practice of guilty pleas in the context of widespread international crimes must be viewed. And that really was the basis upon which I decided to write about this. In terms of just sheer numbers, between 1996 and 2020, I make the point that a total of 230 defendants were either indicted by the various international criminal tribunals or courts, and guilty pleas were obtained from 30 defendants. 29 of those defendants were from the two ad hoc tribunals, the ICTR and the ICTY. The ICC has only obtained a single guilty plea. But why is this important? Well, it's important to say this because up until 2004, the work of the OTP, the Office of the Prosecutor, at the ICTR, was shared between its office in Kigali, the ICTY at The Hague, under the leadership of a single prosecutor. The practical effect of that is that those of us who were involved in the inception of the office of the prosecutor at the ICTR also had the benefit of being involved in what was going on at the ICTY, because it was one single office. As far as I am concerned, in my own case, not only did I negotiate three of the 9 guilty pleas obtained at the ICTR, I was also present at the OTP of the ICTR in 1998, when the very first guilty plea was obtained from Jean Kambanda, who was a former prime minister of Rwanda in 1998. But I was also present at the OTP when the last guilty plea was obtained from Michel Bagaragaza in 2009. Therefore, I felt that I was uniquely placed to gain the necessary insight into the plea bargaining process adopted in the two tribunals during my 12-year-long career, and having myself, of course, led the very complex guilty plea negotiations in Rutenganira, Isengimana, and the Rugambarara cases at the ICTR, I felt that I was able to examine the challenges encountered in those negotiations as indicative from the various plea agreements.
Which puts you in a, as you say, a very unique position to be able to trace the history of guilty pleas in this context. Before our listeners who are less familiar with the statutes of the ICTY and the ICTR, they were silent on this process, weren't they?
No, they were not, actually.
Okay.
You would find that, I think it was Article 20 and Rule 62 of the Statute of the Tribunals that dealt with the issue of plea bargaining. Article 20, clearly, the system itself was laid down in Article 20 of the Statute of the Ad Hoc Tribunal, and was also outlined in Rule 62 of the Rules of Procedure and Evidence. The concept of guilty plea was drawn from common law jurisdictions. To my mind, such practice did not have a direct counterpart in civil law jurisdictions, where the admission of guilt is simply considered as part of the evidence to be considered and evaluated by the court. So the evolution of guilty pleas was quite interesting in the sense that we were able to follow the onset of the negotiations. Most guilty pleas, at least those obtained in national jurisdictions, are secured through a process of plea bargaining. And although plea bargaining may take various forms, what is consistent in the plea bargaining process and what is central to the process is the promise of leniency in the form of a sentencing discount in exchange for a defendant's guilty plea. So at a very basic minimum, that transcends all jurisdictions. However, experience has shown that with international crimes and with international defendants, if I may refer to them as so, several factors other than sentence discounts motivate defendants to plead guilty. Factors such as the nature of the crimes themselves, the prosecution selection process, the background of the defense counsel representing the defendant, the status and cultural and educational backgrounds of the defendants themselves. These are all factors that, in my view, were likely to affect the likelihood of obtaining guilty pleas to international crimes. To that end, of course, my experience has shown that international prosecutors who seek to persuade defendants charged with international crimes to plead guilty must therefore assess a multiplicity of factors in many cases, and they must be strongly motivated to extend the concessions that they're willing to grant these defendants beyond the traditional promise of sentencing discounts, which is what we're all familiar with. So sentencing and charge bargaining are typical forms, and perhaps even the most utilized forms of the plea bargaining process. And of course, a typical charge bargain will involve the prosecutor agreeing to withdraw some charges in exchange for a plea to others, with the aim that the defendant will receive a reduced sentence. Charge bargaining, of course, is common in domestic jurisdictions where the criminal legislation allows for the classification of crimes into well-defined and distinct categories of crimes, which also prescribes a range of sentences for such crimes. But that's a lot more difficult. And that was a lot more difficult to do with international crimes, as such crimes covered such a broad range of different modes of criminal activity. And it was in recognition of this that international judges were allowed to exercise a very broad range of discretion in sentencing, as was catered for in Rule 101 of the ICTR's Rules of Evidence and Procedure. It may well be argued that the practice of international criminal law has not advanced enough to disclose a particular sentencing pattern or is legally binding or a legally binding tariff of sentencing for international crimes. This point was raised in the Anto Furigiya case at the ICTY. That was a judgment of the year 2000, where the judges found that there was no set tariff. So when involved in sentencing bargaining, the prosecutor would always recommend that the court imposes a narrow range of sentencing in exchange for a plea or the defendant's cooperation in ongoing investigations and trials. Indeed, unless the court agrees to sentence a defendant within the range proposed by the prosecutor following a sentence bargain, the prosecutor will be unable to engage in such a process, as his recommendations are only as valuable to the extent that the court adheres to them. So basically, that was important in the work that we did, that basically, if we're not able, if the court is not willing to adhere within the recommendation proposed by the parties in a guilty plea agreement, then there would be less of an incentive for defendants to actually come to the table and enter into this negotiation with us. Now, another form of plea bargaining, which is often referred to as an implicit plea bargaining, which is what occurred in the first phase of the ICTR, refers to an established judicial practice where a court would impose a lower sentence on a defendant who pleads guilty rather than opt for a trial. So at a very basic minimum, just deciding to plead guilty saves the court a lot of time and a lot of money, and you ordinarily should get rewarded for that. Mm-hmm. In those situations, the defendant would plead guilty on the expectation, of course, that the court would discount their sentences based on pre-established considerations and sentencing tariffs. That was the expectation, of course, when John Kambanda, the prime minister of Rwanda, decided to plead guilty. But as we go, you would find that irrespective of the fact that John Kambanda pleaded guilty as the prime minister of Rwanda, he got no recognition whatsoever in his sentencing, and the maximum sentence was actually imposed on him. But we will discuss why that happened, and there are some unique circumstances in that regard. Finally, we found that where a defendant pleads guilty just to secure a tactical advantage, which is often referred to as a tactical plea, such a defendant cannot expect to receive a sentencing discount. This is usually the case where the defendant is caught red-handed and a guilty plea was in fact very certain. Now, as I pointed out, the rules of the ad hoc tribunals specifically lay down the procedure for obtaining guilty pleas. You would find those at Rule 62 of their Rules of Procedure, and Article 20, of course, of the statute actually provided for that. So this procedural shortcut, which is what it is really, in the quest for judicial expediency and efficiency, however, cannot be allowed to curtail the rights of the defendants to a fair trial. Therefore, if a defendant, by pleading guilty, decides to waive his or her right to a trial, it was made clear in the ICTY appeal judgment of 7th October 1997 in Edemovich that such a waiver can only be admitted by the court under very strict conditions. Mm. So not only did the rules of procedure allow for it and the statute of the tribunal allow for it, the jurisprudence of the court, as it evolved, also laid down very strict and stringent conditions upon which trial chambers and judges could accept guilty pleas. So let me stop there as answer to that question, because there's a lot more to answer.
Thank you. So I think that that answer really focuses on the fair trial rights of the defendant in terms of procedure and some of the issues as to when those guilty pleas are acceptable. In an international context, when we're dealing with systematic offending and crimes that deal with a broader range of offending compared to what you would see in most domestic circumstances, how is that broader context of discount, I guess, applied in relation to accounting for that broader range or systematic nature of offending? Is there something at the heart of the kinds of crimes we see in international criminal law that makes this different to what you see in domestic jurisdictions?
If I can talk a bit about some of the conditions that were laid down, mm-hmm. and as part of that discussion, we'll be able to address some of the issues you've raised. One of the main concerns of international criminal law was that there was the realization that by pleading guilty, the defendant in a criminal trial essentially decides to waive his or her right to trial. Mm-hmm. Now, the evolution of the jurisprudence of the ad hoc tribunal was to the effect that such waiver could only be admitted under very stringent conditions. Now, what were those conditions? Well, perhaps the first condition was that the plea itself must be entered in full recognizance of its legal implications. Mm-hmm. Because to do otherwise would vitiate the defendant's right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. In other words, the plea itself must be voluntarily made in full cognizance of the nature of the charge and, more importantly, the consequences of those charges. So international judges found that it was very important to assure themselves of the formal validity of such a plea. The second condition was that the plea itself could not be ambiguous or equivocal. To that end, the jurisprudence that emerged from the cases was indicative of the fact that a defendant could not, on the one hand, plead guilty and similarly seek to nullify that plea by claiming that he or she acted in self-defense or raised any other defense that may exculpate him. So the contents, the very contents of the declaration cannot be ambiguous or equivocal, because the judges felt that that in itself may affect the validity of the plea. And I raised this and I discussed this in the chapter using the Drazen Edemovic case at the ICTY and also the Fernandez case before the East Timorese special panels as examples of how judges remitted cases and refused to accept guilty pleas, because in explaining the factual basis for those pleas, the judges considered that certain criminal defenses had been raised, which put the validity of the plea in question. The third stringent condition, very quickly, mm-hmm. relates to the fact that the choice of pleading guilty relates not only to the fact that the defendant was conscious of having committed a crime and admitted to such a commission, but also to his or her right to adopt or present his or her defense strategy. So when I started this conversation, I said, well, you are waiving a right. You have a constitutional right to present a defense. Hmm. Now, the third stringent condition, which has been formally acknowledged in procedures of international tribunals as established in common law legal systems, is that a plea is one of the elements which constitutes such a defense. So basically, you're entitled to a defense. And if you decide to waive your right to a defense, then the court has to satisfy itself that you understand the consequences of doing so. So whilst the defendant has the full discretion over whichever strategy he decides to adopt in response to charges, the trial chamber must nonetheless ensure that the rights of the defendants are respected, more specifically, the defendant's rights to counsel. So the court will ensure that the plea must be free and voluntary and cannot be obtained by threats, inducement, or promises. And the way the statute ensures that the judges have control over this process is that the statute outlines that judges will not be bound. The judges will not be bound by an agreement between the parties. And this proviso was aimed at ensuring that the sort of distortions that I have indicated and talked about earlier, those sort of distortions will be, the accused will be free of those distortions. And the judges will be able to exercise some level of independence regardless of whatever agreements the prosecutor and the defendant have reached. So they retain that right to reject the plea agreement and say, well, you may have agreed whatever you want with the defendant. We don't think this discloses a cause of action. We don't think that the factual allegations here align with what this defendant is pleading to, and they would completely reject the plea agreement. So those three stringent conditions were decided following the various cases that came up at the ICTY and the ICTR, and that's it's formed the basis upon which judges in international criminal law are considered guilty pleas.
So building then on that second issue of ambiguous or equivocal pleas, because there's a balance, I guess, between evidence that's presented in mitigation of sentence as compared to something that's raising a defense. And I think most common law jurisdiction lawyers listening to the podcast will have some experiences in that fine line. I think most common law jurisprudence says courts won't necessarily go behind the guilty plea unless there's something manifestly wrong with that guilty plea, because there's a number of different reasons that individuals would choose to plead guilty. But there is that distinction between a defense and evidence that's raised in mitigation of sentence.
Right.
So you spoke about the process for plea bargaining being to result in that discount in sentence, or that's one of the expectations of undertaking a guilty plea or issuing a guilty plea through that bargaining process. How did you manage the evidence then in relation to the mitigation of sentence? How was that tested? Is there still a separate sentencing hearing with that evidence being tested, or is that wrapped into what's agreed in the plea negotiations?
Well, it really depended on the cases. And as we discuss the ICTR cases, examples would emerge. Like I said, in the beginning, the first phase of the guilty pleas at the ICTR and the ICTY featured what we term implicit plea bargains. So defendants putting their hands up as charged and pleading to absolutely everything they've been charged with the expectation that having saved the court some time and some money, they would get some consideration in reduction of their sentence. And the prosecutor didn't have to do very much. In fact, the prosecutor did not offer any recommendation as to sentencing and left it to the discretion of the court. However, something changed between 2003 and 2004. And what was that change? There was a shift, radical shift, before both tribunals from the implicit plea bargaining to a more explicit form of charge and sentencing bargaining, which then involved generous concessions from the office of the prosecutor. Now, to answer your question, a very important aspect of charge bargaining lies in the intrinsic link that exists between the bargained charge and the factual allegations agreed upon by the parties as providing a true and sufficient basis for the crimes the defendant has agreed to plead to and or his or her mode of participation in the commission of the said crimes. Now, we didn't have to confront this when we had intrinsic plea bargaining, because basically they were simply pleading to everything they were charged with, regardless of the severity of the crime. There was no bargaining, none whatsoever. And that's indicative from Kambanda, that's indicative from Shiroshago, that's indicative from Ruggiero. They simply just came forward and said, well, we're pleading guilty to everything we've been charged with. We might offer some assistance to the prosecution in ongoing cases, but there was no dropping of charges. There was no alteration in factual allegations. They pleaded guilty to everything they'd be charged with. That whole conduct changed for the reasons that I have spoken about. And this I addressed as part of my discussions on guilty plea negotiations in the Rutaganira case, which was really my first guilty plea negotiation in 2004, I think it was, which was the first time that the defendant agreed to plead guilty based on facts which were less serious to those previously adduced in support of the charges in the indictment. Prior to that, defendants pleaded guilty as charged. So as the jurisprudence of the tribunals evolved, this intrinsic link and the need to amend indictments to reflect the agreement of the parties as regards the defendant's culpable conduct and his or her mode of participation in the commission of crimes became more apparent. And as we move on, you would see the practical effect of that. And I make some very robust arguments from a defense lawyer's point of view, saying, well, had I been a defense lawyer, it would have been foolhardy to allow my client to plead guilty to the most severe international crime in the world and expect any leniency. I mean, that, let's park that discussion.
Yeah, I think that's a whole nother hour.
Or another day.
At least.
This podcast was made by the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the University of Queensland Law School. A full list of episodes and links to additional material, as well as our contact details, are available on our website. Just search for Law and the Future of War. This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present.